The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Not that it was my favorite speech. In fact, it was my least favorite speech because I'm not sure that Kimberly Guilfoyle is over Gavin Newsom yet, and I don't like being yelled at. It was bizarre. But nonetheless, if you can sort of work through the presentation that Guilfoyle offered and just listen to the substance, as she spoke about California, there was some resonance to reality.
If you want to see the socialist Biden-Harris future for our country, just take a look at California. It is a place of immense wealth, immeasurable innovation, an immaculate environment. And the Democrats turned it into a land of discarded heroin needles in parks, riots in streets, and blackouts in homes. In President Trump's America, we light things up.
Yes, okay. She is onto something, though, with respect to California killing the many golden gooses they otherwise enjoy. For more on this, it's starting there, but we've got a lot to get to with him. We're pleased to be joined again by our friend Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University, Executive Director of the Urban Reform Institute, and author of the indispensable new book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism. Joel, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So with respect to California, you wrote about this recently, too, in your piece at City Journal about Kamala's America. You write about California's one-party system, and it's important the way you break it down because you start to understand why things are the way they are. Revolves around well-organized, well-funded interests, including tech moguls, but also Hollywood executives, green nonprofits, the unions. That's who brought Harris to the fore. But it's bigger than Harris. It also speaks to the feudal system in California writ large.
Definitely. What you have is when you criticize what's happening in California, the progressives either ignore you or attack you. Although in one party state, you can just ignore people, you know.
I know it well in Illinois, yes.
Yeah. I mean, what you have is a situation where people who, if there was a Republican government in California, they'd be screaming their heads off and be completely correct in doing so. But because California is, in quote, the model for the Democratic Party, I mean, Democrats are not crazy enough to look at Bill de Blasio and say, well, that's, we want the country to look like New York. I don't think that they're not that deluded. But California, because it does have some fantastic strengths, I mean, I've lived here now for 50 years. I think it's got some great things about it, is a more attractive model until you start looking at highest rate of poverty in the U.S., a third of all the welfare recipients, a diminishing home ownership rate, the movement of middle-class families of all ethnic groups out of the state. Those are not signs of success, I'm sorry. Unless you're willing to confront these issues, your ideals of being a progressive have more to do with virtue signaling than reality.
Well, and again, you have a flight from California, you have a flight from Illinois, you have a flight from New York. This will present itself after the census is completed in the loss of one or more congressional districts in all of those states with major cities, California with multiple major cities. I mean, isn't that the largest indictment of a place, particularly one that features so many intrinsic benefits as California does, from the weather to the coastline, all the natural resources, that people are fleeing it to the desert, literally, like Arizona or Vegas?
Yeah, and they're even going to places like Texas, which are
right,
are not remotely as attractive. And even to some extent, they're moving to places in the middle part of the country, Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas. I mean, it is astounding to see this. And I think fundamentally what we're going to see is that California, it is inconceivable to a Californian like myself. I mean, I'm originally from New York, but, you know, 50 years, I guess I have right to call myself a Californian. To see our state lose a representative, to see the city of Los Angeles, where I spent 40 years, losing population. The Bay Area is probably going to follow. Certainly San Francisco is going to follow in the next few years. You're really talking about how do you screw that up? How do you make that not work? And then you're saying, we have policies that haven't worked very well in California, and we're going to impose them in the rest of the country. And here's the reality. The rest of the country can't remotely compete in a California-structured economy because you don't have the big tech companies, so you know, who kind of bail out the budget, you know, on a regular basis. You don't have the appeal to people from around the world who want to live in this place, you know, which has enormous attractions. You take a California economic regulatory regime and put it into Texas or Illinois or Michigan, and you have a disaster.
I want to pick up right there because you've written two pieces recently. One is The Twilight of Great American Cities is Here. The other is The Heartland's Revival. And I would think that the first would preclude the second. So I want you to explain when we come back, and I'm sure he will be able to do that definitely. He's Joel Kotkin, the author of The Coming of Neo-Feudalism. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University, ED of the Urban Reform Institute, and author of The Coming of Neo-Feudalism. And Joel, as I was saying before the break, on the one hand, you're projecting the twilight of American cities is upon us. On the other hand, you wrote a piece for American Affairs Journal in which you talked about the Heartland's coming revival. Well, the Heartland features some major cities, too. Chicago, which is seeing people flee it like it's on fire because it has been, as well as, you know, I mean, other Rust Belt cities, major cities or mid-major cities that are struggling as well. So reconcile those two theses for me.
First of all, what I was talking about were the primary cities in America, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, all losing population. When I talked about Heartland, it's not Chicago. I mean, what's interesting to me is the middle part of the country, that part of the country, so say the central time zone, many of those cities are doing quite well. But the reality is that people are moving to the Heartland, but they're not necessarily moving just to the big cities. They are in places like Texas. But a lot of times they're moving to smaller, medium-sized cities. And then they're also moving to cities that are not necessarily in the Heartland, like cities like Phoenix, as you mentioned. They're moving there. But there are a lot of people moving to small, mid-sized cities. What's really interesting is for the last couple of years, we now have a stronger migration to cities under a million than cities over a million.
Yeah.
We hadn't seen that in I can't even recall ever seeing that.
Give us your handle on the combination of factors that you think is driving it. Is it simply just basically cost of living versus opportunity combined now with public safety?
I would say there are several things. One is public safety, but in two senses. One, dense urban areas have a fatality rate about three times those of less dense areas and eight times those of rural areas. So although there are outbreaks in small towns and there are outbreaks in some isolated areas like Native American reservations, for instance, in parts of the Rio Grande Valley, the reality is that from a public health point of view, if you're not taking transit and you're not living in crowded housing, your chances of getting COVID and particularly getting very sick or even dying are much less. So there's that issue. Then we have this new issue, which is one that we actually kind of thought had disappeared, which was the crime issue, which had, you know, I'm old enough to remember living in New York in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, and, you know, you were constantly looking to see if somebody was about to mug you. That is beginning to come back. That was something that we thought we had figured out how to keep under control, and now we are just, you know, allowing it to happen, you know, with people getting, you know, being even with serious charges against them are being, you know, let out. You know, there's no question in my mind that looting is now becoming directly linked with the protests. With the looters, sometimes seems to be, you know, the protesters open the field and then the
looters. Synchronized. Yeah, right. Well, and here's the thing too. You know, we played this clip from Ice Cube, of all people, yesterday on the show. I mean, here's a gentleman whose net worth is north of $150 million, his rap career and his acting career. And he sort of has some of this, I think. He's starting to piece it together. But there's a real disconnect. On the one hand, he says 42% of black businesses may close, in part because of violence, in part because of the lockdowns. But his response is sort of to go back to the same old governed by color programs that have failed over the last 50 years. So on the one hand, he sees what is being wrought, but he doesn't want to ascribe responsibility to the people who are making the decisions that are driving these consequences. And I just wonder if you agree with something that I've said. This has been more about racial cohesion than specifically about peace in our streets and sort of a restoration of a common set of principles and, frankly, bringing down these urban feudal systems that you write about, and that it will necessarily have to be led by black Americans. They're going to have to do the yeoman's work, to borrow a word that you use in your book, to provide leadership here, because they have a moral standing that, frankly, in the minds of many, someone like me doesn't have.
I wrote a book, and I tried to understand, why do ethnic groups succeed? One of the things that came out very clearly in that is that ultimately, if you sit around and wait for white people to have the, in quote, correct racial views and acknowledge how horrible, you know, their ancestors were, although my ancestors were living in the shtetl in Russia and never saw a black person until they got to New York in 1910. But the reality is groups succeed through their own devices, you know, discipline, marriage, family, you know, business ownership. And African-Americans have had wonderful examples of this in Durham, North Carolina, in black communities on Central Avenue in Los Angeles, thriving business communities, thriving universities. And you build up those institutions, and then they can't. This is what you think of here in the state of California. The most discriminated group in the state of California is not African Americans.
Asians.
Not been Hispanics. It's been Asians. Mm-hmm. Asians have been barred from owning land. They've had pogroms against them here in the state of California. Okay? What is the most successful ethnic group in the state of California? Asians. Why is that? Hard work, education, family, willingness to defer gratification, and those are the very same things. And you know, I'm gonna combine three very different people in this from the African American perspective: Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, and Malcolm X. All of them said the exact same thing, which is, you have to improve yourself inside. You can't wait for sort of mass re-education camps to get white people to think the way you want them to think. That doesn't work. Ultimately, by the way, it can't work, because at the end of the day, most people, even millennials, do not want to hate themselves.
He is Joel Kotkin. He is the Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University, ED of the Urban Reform Institute, and author of the book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism. Joel, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.